Hello again, and welcome to yet another episode of A Minor Podcast, the best podcast in the world about classical music, and when we get to it, music of other persuasions as well. Once more, Impy will be your host, guiding you through the intricate world that is classical music, and I am Massey, her barely coherent producer. Today we have a vocal treat for you in a very literal sense, as we're going to be talking about and listening to so-called motets, which are vocal pieces, by the Renaissance composer Thomas Tallis. Well, MP, first things first, who was Thomas Tallis?
Well, he's one of the most influential sacred vocal composers ever. But because of the time he was born, not much is actually known about his early life, even where or when he was born. Historians place his date of birth around 1500 to 1520, and the place of birth is Kent. But it's really speculation more than anything. We do know he worked as an organist in some churches and monasteries, but his story as a composer really begins when he was court composer and performer for Henry VIII and subsequent queens and kings of England.
So if it's not known where he's born and not much about his early life, how has he been placed in Kent at that time?
The time period of 15 to 1520, obviously they're just going back in his life and working backwards how old he would have been at certain prominent points in his career. So that's kind of, you know, it's still a 20-year swing, but at least you could think that's a fairly good estimate. The Kent connection is a little bit more speculation. They just know he had a cousin with the last name Sayer. I'm not entirely sure where that information came from, but apparently that's what the historians say. And Tallis and Sayer were very common names, which a lot of connection in Kent at the time. So that was kind of where they came up with that.
Well, today we would say that not that much to go on, but I guess it's all we have, so we have to go on.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right.
The piece we're going to listen to today, among other, we have to, actually two pieces. The main piece we're going to be listening to, Spem in Allium, I think it's called.
I believe.
I'm not good at Latin.
Yeah, we are good at pronouncing.
Yeah, we are going to butcher yet another language. We promised that in the previous episode. It's Latin for hope in any other, and it's what's known as a motet. But what is a motet?
Yeah, a motet, it's a pretty wide blanket term, meaning basically a vocal musical composition. The term originated really in the Renaissance, meaning a piece of music in several parts with words, which, you know, is pretty broad. But that's very much what Spem in Allium is. It has a lot of different vocal lines flowing together and has words. So, yeah, that would kind of be the explanation. And the term motet kind of expanded out after that into many different styles and forms. Like some of the Baroque motets, they had a full orchestra, like orchestra instrumentation as well as the voices. The form did die down a bit in the 19th century, but a lot of German composers did continue with it. Voices with or without instrumental accompaniment. There's some that they just used organ and voices. So it is a pretty broad blanket term, but of a traditional sense of a motet, Spem in Allium is definitely a great example.
Okay. So this is from the Renaissance area.
Yes.
Which, of course, precedes the Baroque area. So we're pre-1600.
Yes, that's correct.
I mean, at this time, a lot of music, because of the intricacies involved in it and in these elaborate kinds of music, were often written with religious motives. The choral works like this, which required a lot of people. In this case, Spem in Allium has, 40 voices?
Yes, 40 voices.
I mean, were they written with religious motives?
Well, I mean, like Tallis himself, he's purely known as a sacred vocal music composer, and there's no records of him composing anything that was non-religious or instrumental or not religious in the religious liturgy or canon. So in theory, it would be purely a praise of God. But at this time, especially in England, there was a lot of turmoil going on because of the whole monarchy was switching over from Catholicism to Protestantism. So the music composed for the court and for the monarchy certainly had a political edge to it. And there was definitely harsh consequences for people if you were on the wrong side. And Tallis, despite being like a staunch Catholic through all this time, managed to navigate the waters quite well and write the right services at the right time. So again, in theory, a purely a praise of God, but I think definitely political in nature of having to do the right thing for the right people, which of course God would not really be so worried about.
So basically, it was just him trying to cover his hindsight.
Yes, exactly.
And
yep.
Yeah, it must have taken a man of a certain charisma to remain in good stance with people during this time.
And through so many as well, because he started with Henry VIII. I mean, then it was Edward VII, Mary the first, then Elizabeth the first. So, like, and all of them had their different ways that they wanted the services and the music played, and he managed to deal with all of that and finagle his way through all those different monarchs and stuff as well, which is kind of pretty incredible when you think about it. Seeing as at that time, I think they were a little, you know, touchy.
A little touchy. and yes, that is really impressive for him to navigate those waters, as you say.
Yeah, and
amazing.
Yeah, I think a mixture of charisma and just sheer talent must have carried him through.
I mean, the music he wrote was and still is, of course, absolutely beautiful.
Yes.
So and it is moving. So maybe that has helped a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And because
people do like music.
Yeah, and it was like very much a show of, you know, we have the best court composers, we have the best performers. That was kind of part of the thing. So obviously they wanted to have the best to show off, you know. I mean, that's evident throughout all the composers who were court composers in their time. I mean, there was obviously Mozart was one that as we've all seen Amadeus, that as a court composer, because they want the best, because they are the monarchy, so they're the top of the country, they want the top composers. So I think that was definitely part of it, but definitely charisma as well. When to stay staunchly Roman Catholic and be able to write for Protestant kings and queens who were very passionate about their Protestantism, I would say, I think that's, yeah,
yes,
pretty incredible.
That is really incredible. Yeah,
yes.
That would be hard to imagine.
Yeah, like the time of it. It's
The time of it. That is the kind of time where not following along with what your king did could easily cost you your head.
Oh, very much so. Yes. Yeah. We know.
That, as we know, is generally a problem for a healthy life.
That's not very. Especially for composing music, you need your head about you a bit.
yes. Well, it would be natural for places like churches and monasteries. I mean, with the wealth they possessed, it would be natural for them to foot the bill of all of this, since, you know, employing and training a choir is something complex and even then really costly. And you want some return on investment in a sort of sense.
Yeah.
Did that mean the results, the performances, were reserved for the upper class or the aristocracy, or was it part of the mass or church service for ordinary people as well?
Yeah, because back then it was common for poorer people to send their sons into the monastery in order for them to get an education, and a big part of the monastery life was church services and singing and like doing the different the morning song, the even song, all of the different. So singing took up a lot of the day for these young boys going into the monastery. And church really was a big part of life for the ordinary people. So I think that the church services were for ordinary people back then, especially because at the time there was a printer from Venice called Ottavaria Petrucci, I believe. Sorry, Italians. In 1501, he actually printed and made written music widely available, like all across Europe, for a very cheap cost. So before then, it used to be wealthy people would be able to practice and play and learn music at home. This opened it up so anyone could be able to learn to read, learn to play music as well. So that kind of had it so that you had some homegrown people. You didn't have to necessarily put all the money into training them. So it's just kind of an interesting fact that the printing press came along and really opened up music as well as words, as well as everything, to ordinary people, as it were, rather than just the wealthy, rather than just the people in power.
Yeah, because at this time, you say 1501, when I think Ottaviano Petrucci,
there it is, yeah,
printed this. I mean, the movable type printing press was less than 100 years old at this time. It was like, what, 70 years old?
Yeah.
And it just goes to show that even then music had an enormous importance, because this new technology, one of the first things it was really used for, is to print music, to preserve it, to spread it, to distribute it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, because that's
kind of amazing. A fun thing about the duties towards ordinary people in the monasteries.
Yes, absolutely.
Is that is the word hospital.
Yeah.
It is, in fact, I mean, we have the word hospital today. It's a place where you put sick people.
Yeah.
But as we know, there is the word hospitality, and originally the hospital was actually a place monasteries ran for ordinary people and travelers who could seek shelter there and have a meal there when they traveled to pilgrimages and all that.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, because that's...
And that's where the hospitality part of it comes from.
Yeah.
And then when it became more for just sick people,
yeah,
because
yeah,
they couldn't get accommodations anywhere else.
Oh, okay.
But they were always welcome in the monasteries. Just a little, yeah, a tidbit here. Okay, Thomas Tallis was, unlike the composers before him, he was one of the first composers to write his anthems and motets and vocal pieces set to English words instead of Latin, as had been the norm up until then. Why did he choose that?
Yeah, well, that's because, kind of like we were talking about before, with England then becoming a Protestant nation. From my research, it seems that the Anglican liturgy was introduced during Edward VII's reign, which is after Henry VIII, which is where Tallis was employed by Henry VIII, but he stayed in service. And that's why Thomas Tallis started to write in English. It kind of went back and forth throughout the 1500s, depending on who was in charge, whether he wrote in Latin or in English. But with Edward VII, he wanted it in English, and he wanted a specific musical style as well. Like his later works are more the ones we closely relate to Tallis, and the multi-voice polyphony. And polyphonic music is a type of musical texture that comprises two or more independent lines of melody going on at once, rather than just like a single melody, like a solo accompanied by chords or harmonies. This would have two, three, and in the case of the Sperminalium, as we'll hear later, 40 different musical lines kind of going on all at the same time. But during the time of Edward VII, he liked it when they wrote English words and a very simple style, as he said, to each syllable a plain and distinct note. So, like, to hear an example of this, we have his anthem, Thomas Tallis's anthem, If Ye Love Me. And let's have a quick listen to that so you can kind of see what we're talking about there. And you can kind of hear in that piece how all the four voices change pretty much at the same time. As was mentioned before, one syllable, one note. This is what they would call homophonic music, but I think we get arrested if we say that today. So, but that, yeah, exactly. But that's a proper term, people. We're not saying anything bad. After Edward VII, Queen Mary came in and she changed it all back to Latin. Then Elizabeth I came back in for English. And it kind of went so back and forth like this. And during Elizabeth as well, he did write some Latin things as well. It's just kind of depending on the type of service that they wanted, the time. And it was just kind of a crazy period for having to be like a religious court composer, because I can't even imagine, as we talked about earlier, how you navigate all that waters, because, yeah, you didn't want to lose your head. So.
Oh, definitely not. Ooh. And that is, yeah, he must really have had a good feel for what each of them wanted from
yeah.
him.
Yes, absolutely.
Amazing. And I really like in this, If You Love Me, it's... It's basically around.
Yes, very much.
You know, it's one starts and then the next bar, the next line starts and so forth.
Yeah, and it's very much an early example of like a fugue, which is basically what we would call around. But yeah, it's like the different line gets taken up by the next group. And yeah, it is very much like that.
It's a little more advanced than what we did when I was a Boy Scout.
Yeah, what, row, row, row your boat.
And a lot more beautiful.
Yes.
Wow. Okay, so let's not dwell on that. I've tried to repress it for over 30 years now. Anyway, the main work we're dealing with today is Bemin Allium. I don't know if it's his his biggest piece or what, but it's definitely a huge accomplishment.
Absolutely.
Not only for him, but in choral works in general.
Yeah, absolutely.
Spem and Allium, when was it written?
It was written around 1570, again, not entirely sure of the exact date, but there's definitely a record of it being around in 1572, and it seems like it was written, again, 1570. It's just hard to get exact dates of things. You just kind of have to go on performances and where records of where it's actually existed. So that's what we're thinking.
Okay. So, but a piece of this magnitude and scale, I mean, again, 40 voices, that's not written, you know, just for fun. So why was it written? Do we know that?
There are a few stories about why. Not sure exactly if they are true or if it's just kind of a mixture of truth or what, but they're very interesting. Like, the first one was, there was an Italian composer, Alessandro Striggio. Again, apologies to our Italian listeners. And he had visited London in 1567, and he had created a 40-voice mass. And him and Talis, there's definitely records that they met. And it seems that perhaps either he was inspired by that, or he didn't want to be outdone by that. So that maybe spurred on some inspiration there. Another story claims that the Duke of Norfolk commissioned it to be formed at Nonsuch House. And there is records of that work being performed there. Because the motet itself is made up of 8 choirs with 5 voices in each choir. And the setup at Nonsuch was that there were 4 first floor balconies kind of around you. So the setup would be 4 of the 8 choirs could sing from those, and then the rest on the floor kind of all around you. So it would be like a crazy mega surround sound. And when you hear the piece, you'll see how the music goes from one choir to the next choir, which would create this kind of amazing effect. If you had them coming, sound coming from above, coming from around, coming from behind, it'd just be crazy. So that's one story about why it was written. And then I think the most widely believed version is that it was written for Elizabeth I's birthday. I think it was her 40th birthday, and she was the Queen of England at the time. So this probably is the most likely scenario, but it's not that perhaps the other 2 scenarios maybe played a part in it as well. Again, we don't know for sure, but I think it's probably a mixture of all 3, to be honest.
Yeah, it's often the case. I'm always amazed at this, that we have a musical notation system.
Yes.
That is so perfect that we can recreate 500-year-old music.
Yeah.
To a T.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Today.
And it's not just the notation systems, it's the tempo markings, which we are going to get into at a later date. It's the expressions, it's like everything you need to know is in this system. You know how loud to play, how quiet, yes, to play. It's incredible. And it's interesting as well, because we were talking about the printing press, but in 1875, Talis and another young composer who was also doing vocal works very much in Talis's style, called William Byrd, were granted a patent to print and publish music. And this was like one of the only first times this has ever been done in England. So it kind of gave him a very creative advantage with him and Byrd to get performances for their work, because they had the music. And then on top of that, with him being so popular with the monarchy, he and Byrd were basically given the monopoly on writing polyphonic music. So like that also set him up as being like the bigwig of the day. It's like thinking if the Beatles had gotten a patent to be the only ones to write pop music. Like, that's the kind of effect it had, yeah, on the music scene there. It's quite incredible to kind of think about that, especially, again, like we talked about, the printing press had such a huge impact on the musical world.
I mean, what are the differences between... You compose. So what are the differences between writing for voices versus writing for instruments? Are there any?
To me, because I view the voice as an instrument, I don't see it as like a big difference or any more than writing for a different instrument. You know, like if you write for a violin, obviously you write in a different way than you do for a French horn because you have different things to consider. The French horn, you have to be like, you have to breathe at some point, so you have to factor that kind of stuff in. You know what I mean? Like things like with the violin, the way the strings are set up, you have to know that, okay, they need to be able to get to this note from this string. It's just different considerations. So I see it the same with the vocal writing. There's just different considerations that you take into account when writing for that as an instrument. Of course, you do have to like use words a lot of the time. I mean, sometimes it's not always words, but you know, to fit in a syllable in the right place and getting it like real flowing is another challenge. To me, I just think it's just a different instrument and it just has its own unique characteristics, just like any other instrument.
Yeah, I know I've written some songs myself. And especially about getting the syllables right,
yeah,
on the melody can be a really, really tricky thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes you try to make it fit, but that won't ever work because you just end up with a word that sounds really unnatural.
Yes.
All of the
yes,
sudden.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that I know that if I heard a song with a word sounding really unnatural, it would take me out of the moment.
Yeah,
immediately.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think because, you know, humans are very word orientated, so that's what we pick up on when we hear music and we hear a song. We do listen to the words and we do listen to the sounds of the words, so it would affect you just like someone playing the wrong note if it's a wrong syllable. It's the same effect to it, so it does take you out of the moment, and it is a very tricky part of vocal writing, I would say, definitely, especially if you have to write 40 voices in Latin. That would not be easy.
Yes. Well, let's I think this is about time we actually get to Speminalium.
Yep, absolutely.
So let's do that.
Yeah, so as you can hear there, there's a huge difference between the earlier piece we played, the Edward VII kind of blocky style of If You Love Me, and this has a much more flowing, much more continuous movement. It's really quite incredible how it flows and how it just keeps moving throughout the whole. It's depending on which recording you listen to, it's a 10, 12-minute piece. It is just so beautiful. I just love that piece so much.
It is very, very beautiful, very angelic, and I can imagine. I can't even imagine how it would have sounded to someone in the Renaissance period in a huge
Oh,
cathedral
wow.
or something like
Yeah.
that. It must have been absolutely
Oh,
otherworldly,
yeah.
and especially when you say we have eight different choirs of five voices placed in different locations.
Yes. Yeah, incredible.
To have the music travel and move around like
Yeah,
that—that
definitely.
that must have been
Oh,
amazing.
yeah.
And yes, if you love me, the shorter piece from before—it just does have a far more rigid structure, as you mentioned. One syllable per note, and you can follow it like clockwork.
Yeah.
But it's still beautiful in its own right. Absolutely still beautiful in
Yeah,
its own
absolutely. It's
right.
just a very different style, but it's just interesting to point out like the different styles that the different monarchs were interested in and what they kind of mandated for their religious music and stuff. But it's still all beautiful.
Yeah.
All it's just different styles of greatness, basically. But as we said, like the motet, it's eight choirs with five voices. It has a soprano, which is the highest female voice, alto, second highest female voice, tenor, highest male voice, or in not the highest possible one, but in the normal choral structure, it's the highest. A baritone, which is the mid male voice, and then bass, which is obviously the lowest. So it is likely that Tallis did intend his singers to stand like in a horseshoe shape, so that, as we talked about before, that effect of the different musical lines traveling back and forth around the room would be prominent. And it just begins with like a single voice from the first choir, and then the other voices join in an imitation. Each in turn falls silent as the music moves around. And then at some point, I can't remember the exact time, so forgive me, but all 40 voices enter simultaneously for a few bars. And it's like this big, like, moment where everything kind of comes together. But then the pattern of opening
Yes.
is reversed, and the music goes back from when it went from the first choir to the eighth choir. It goes back from the eighth to the first. So it's continuous rippling back and forth throughout the choirs and the different voices. So then after that, we heard there was a brief full section, and then the choir starts singing in what's called antiphonal pairs, and that's just basically a question and answer. One voice starts and then the other voice finishes it, and they do this a lot in religious music where it's like I say question and answer. Someone starts the first bit of the scripture, then they have the second bit. So it's very, very beautiful. And they're just throwing that sound around in that space between them. And then, again, we talked about imagine just hearing that live in a cathedral. Oh, it would just be,
It would be extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary, and it also shows the brilliance of a composer like Tallis,
Yes.
because not only does he have to write these eight different sections, five different voices in
Yeah.
each, and they have to be in harmony with each other, they have to be to follow a certain overall structure
Yes.
with each other.
Yeah.
But he also imagined how it would be, how the performance would have to be,
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
and took that into the overall consideration when writing this
Yeah,
piece.
exactly. Yes.
That That is really something.
Yeah, because it does affect the performance. I mean, you know, it's a little bit, we've talked about Wagner and how he, you know, he went over the top, obviously, by building a giant theater. But it's that same thing of like, okay, this is more than just the sound. It's how is the sound going to be presented? And especially with cathedrals, there's acoustics to take into account, there's positioning to take into account. There's so many things beyond just the notes that you need to really look at. And it is incredible how Tallis worked and thought about and planned to have the effects he wanted in the space that he had.
I mean, to a very large extent, it's something that we've only just recently came back to in a cinematic sense
Yeah.
with surround sound and now, Dolby Atmos and whatnot, where there's sound from the sides and from the back
Yeah,
and the
yeah,
bottom
yeah.
and the top and,
What was that
some.
in the cinema? It was always THX, and it had all the and
Oh,
they
yeah.
did it the crinkling at the back, and it went all around the sides to give you the effect of what it
Yeah.
was. Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of, yeah, that's.
But I mean, this is what a man like Tallis or Wagner actually had in
Yeah,
mind.
yes, working with what.
Only it was more than a century ago. In Tallis's, it was 5 centuries
Yeah,
ago.
exactly. They didn't have surround sound speakers. They had to figure it out live. That's it's
Yeah.
incredible. It really is. It's stuff like that that, again,
But
sorry, I was saying stuff like that, people don't really realize how much goes into that whole performance of stuff just that long ago. Especially now, we're all spoiled with the electronic equipment, and we can just, you know, pan it out and do this and do that. This, they really had to get it how they wanted it through organic means.
yeah. But it does feel a little sad that we then listen to it in stereo
I
only.
know, I know. We need to get like 8 speakers set up and get a good playing of it. And unless we could get together 40 voices, if we've got any singers out there that want to join us.
I'm gonna have to give up my bed if I'm gonna have any more speakers in here, but I'm willing to make that sacrifice, I think.
Yes. But
Okay.
yeah, just to get back to the piece, then all the voices join in for the culmination of the work after we've had this antiphonal back and forth. And it's like composed in an innovative style, and occasionally it is homophonic, like the previous piece, but the individual vocal lines act very freely within the elegant harmonic framework. And this allows for like a large number of individual musical ideas to be implemented during its, let's say it's about 10 to 12 minutes, depending on which recording you get. Some do it faster, some do it slower. But it's really a study in contrasts. The individual voices sing and then silent in turns. Sometimes they're alone, sometimes they're in choirs, sometimes they're calling, sometimes they're answering, sometimes it's all together. So while it seems like 40 voices going on all at once would just be kind of a big monotonous mess, it really is constantly changing and presenting new ideas, and it just constantly flowing music. It's just beautiful.
That is absolutely amazing. I would definitely recommend that we're listening to this piece again in headphones.
Yes, definitely.
It's not gonna be the cathedral experience, but it is definitely it's definitely recommendable to put on a good pair of
Yeah,
headphones
absolutely. And as usual,
and listening
yeah,
to Spam and Alien.
absolutely. And we'll put links down below so you can look it up and re-listen to it again.
Yes,
Absolutely.
and you definitely should.
Yes. And any other work by Tallis is never a waste of time as well. So we've got that.
Especially there's the ensemble called the Tallis Scholars.
Yes, they're excellent.
that are worth. They don't only deal with Thomas Tallis though. They deal with Renaissance, sacred Renaissance music in general.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, they have some. They have some recordings of Bird's music. Who we talked about had the patent with Thomas Tallis. He's an excellent composer of that era. John Tavner is another one. So there's.
Yeah.
They do a lot of those. Yeah, Renaissance choral works that are all very, very beautiful.
Very beautiful.
Yes.
Well, I guess that was it for this time.
Yes.
We hope you enjoyed this short travel into sacred choral music from the Renaissance era. And, of course, we hope you'll join us again next week when we scratch the surface of the monolith that is Beethoven. In this instance, the works Allegro con Brio and Adagio Cantabile, both sonatas for violin and piano. What a sonata is and what allegro and adagio means will all be covered in the next episode, so make sure to tune in for that.
Absolutely. And of course, don't forget to like and subscribe and share with friends or family or enemies, if that's your thing. But we appreciate that very much. And this is a minor podcast, so until next time, this is your producer Mazzy, your host MP, and we will see you again. Bye-bye.